I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There and welcome to Tell Me Your Tales. Thanks for downloading this episode and being with me again and letting me fill your ears with another conversation for a bit over an hour. I think this one goes for about an hour and 15 minutes, and it's with Adam Diddick, the Australian marathon coach. He was in charge of the Australian marathon team at the 2014 Commonwealth Games over in Glasgow and also the 2016 Olympic Games at Rio. So quite a big get for the podcast. He did say he listens to the show most weeks, which is pretty cool. Tried to get as many questions as possible in to kind of suit the listeners as much as possible. So hopefully you get a lot of insight out of it. It was a great opportunity for a guy like me who's kind of aspiring to be that next level of athlete, I suppose, to be able to talk to the guys in charge of the marathon team when they go to these major competitions. So really grateful for his time and had fun talking to him. He's very good at generating conversation, and his responses are detailed. I don't say much at all, so some people could be happy about that. And it was tough to get a word in because he was so detailed and so deep with his responses, which is something I really appreciate. Adam did pass on a video that is made of all the images that he took on his camera at Rio. I'll include in the show notes because we got quite deep with that Rio conversation there, and some of these images are really from behind the scenes, so I think you'll get a bit out of it. It goes for about 10 minutes, and it's just like a slideshow of different photos that he took from his Rio experience, which is pretty cool seeing some of that behind the scenes stuff. So I'll include that in the show notes, and hopefully you get a bit of value out of that as well. Anyway, guys, that's enough from me today. Enjoy this chat with Australian marathon coach Adam Diddick. Cheers. Beautiful, mate. Sure. Let's do it. Yo, Adam Diddick, welcome to our Tell Me Your Tales podcast. Thanks for giving us some time.
No worries, Brady. Anytime.
All the way from Noosa. Tell us what you're doing up there.
Currently I'm just sort of spending a bit of time on the Gold Coast through Brisbane and up at Noosa just to check out a few potential training locations prior to the Comm Games. So this morning we had a bit of a look at the marathon course and like that. And, just up at Noosa to hopefully see if it'll be an appropriate location for us to set up just prior to the team getting together at in Nudgee in Brisbane. So, I've never been up here. I've heard a lot of good things about the running, but thought it's worth me coming up and having a look. And I'm not the kind of guy that likes to take chances on these things. If we can get it right in our hometown, then we should be doing that.
Yeah, for sure. Tell us about the course. What are your thoughts on it?
Oh, look, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. It's not an overly complex course, but it's nice just to be able to see it and get a bit of perspective. It's very similar to what people would experience in the Gold Coast Marathon. So anyone who's run that would notice a lot of similarities. It's kind of almost run in reverse where they go out the opposite direction first and then finish with the area at Burley Heads and back for the latter part of the course. So, it's good. There's no reason why it can't be fast if the conditions are good. I quite like the course. So, I always liked it. It's just the Gold Coast is sometimes a bit challenging time of year for some of the international crew.
Yeah, so no dreaded running past the finish line at 34, 32K, whatever it was?
There is, yeah. It's just short of 10K into the course.
Yeah.
They run past the finish line. So, yeah, there is that. But, I mean, you know, you've got to be prepared and experienced enough to be able to manage all of that anyway. So that's what we would expect from our top marathoners.
Yeah, that's it. Hey, mate, what I usually do is get the guests to introduce themselves. So do you want to maybe give the listeners a bit of insight? And, yeah, feel free to tell us as much or as little as possible about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, well, first of all, I guess I'd probably describe myself as a failed runner, someone who probably always was probably likely to go into coaching, but I probably did that 10 years earlier than I expected. And I think from the coaching side of things, I took on an athlete called Jess Trengo when she was 20, and 4 years later we had her at the Olympics. So pretty steep learning curve for me. And after London, you know, I always aimed to have two athletes at Rio, and fortunately enough for me, I had another sensational athlete, Madeline Hills, or Heiner at the time, organised to be coached by myself. And so managed to be going to Rio Olympics with Jess in the marathon and Madeline in the 3,000 steeplechase and the 5,000. And from there, it's kind of been, you know, a bit of a dream come true. But, you know, a lot of hard work in between, a lot of challenging lessons along the way, and hopefully something that sets me up to be able to continue working with athletes at a top level and getting some really great results out of them. You know, my aim's always been to sort of try and put South Australia on the map in regards to distance running, and I feel like we're getting a really good standard happening in South Australia, and then I thought, well, let's see what we can do on an Australian level and see if we can be taken really seriously internationally, and I think some of our athletes are doing a great job of that, and hopefully I can help pushing a few more people up to that standard as well.
Yeah, let's go back to the failed run a bit, because I think I raced against you, correct me if I'm wrong, but did you win the Eagle Hawk to Bendigo foot race like years and years ago? It would have been
2004.
I was going to say 10 years ago, but yeah, that was correct. Yeah, yep.
Yeah. So you know, I did win that one.
You had some good PBs.
That was my best race ever. I guess as a runner, I was tracking along okay in South Australia. I think probably like most of the athletes of my generation at that time, kind of felt like we needed to move away from Adelaide to you know, progress in our running. Few sort of circumstances personally, I decided I'd go to college in America, and I had 1 year eligibility and went to the University of Memphis, and progressed nicely over there. Didn't do anything amazing. Probably my proudest moment in Memphis was graduating. I had to do 2 years worth of study in 1 year, and for anyone who's been to college in the US, you'll know how many credit hours subjects are worth, and I had to knock off 60 credit hours in 1 year to graduate, and I managed to pull that off somehow, and so that was my greatest achievement over there. My running was you know, not much better than what it was back in Adelaide. And then I came back and spent a year in Adelaide and made a few changes within what I was doing. Then I, you know, did the smart thing of sending two of my best mates over to college. So I lost my best training partner, Daniel Mattner. And at that stage, Rod Griffin was coaching me out of Ballarat. So when Dan went over to the States, I decided, well, I haven't got too much going on here in Adelaide for myself. So I just finished university as a teacher. So I decided, well, look, I'll go to Ballarat and I'll be able to get some relief teaching and all the rest of it done there. And so I moved to Ballarat. So I was very fortunate to see young Collis Birmingham and train with him for a year. You know, had a really great coach in Rod Griffin. And that was the year that obviously we had the Eagle Hawk to Bendigo race.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Rod said, look, here's a great opportunity, Adam. You can get your name on a trophy with Rob Dijkstra and Steve Monaghetti. I thought, oh, this sounds good. So I went down to Bendigo for the day and ran that and had a good run. Actually, I was pretty happy with that one. Came away and added my name to a trophy with some legends. Probably was one of the slowest winning times, but, you know, I'll take it for what it was. And not long after that, basically entered that summer season with some Achilles issues, which continued to progress and probably put me in a position where the running wasn't really going to plan over there. And that was really no one's fault. It was more my own and just the injury scenario. So I decided to move back to Adelaide, where I had some teaching opportunities put towards me, and moved back to Adelaide. And within a week of moving back to Adelaide, found the woman who ended up becoming my wife, Kate. And honestly, just sort of went back there. You know, Dan had moved back from the US. He, just like me, had just 1 year eligibility to take advantage of. And we continued training together. And at that stage, I'd sort of had Sean Crichton take me on as one of his athletes. And I really loved working with Sean. And probably had a huge influence on my philosophies of training and all the rest of it. And, you know, it's hard not to trust a guy who achieved what he did with his running. And I think you get a lot of confidence working with someone at that level. Unfortunately, I can't really offer that level of confidence to my athletes. So I kind of have to rely on my coaching, because I certainly don't have the results to back myself like a legend like Sean did, but certainly got a lot of experience from him. And kind of got back, and the Achilles didn't really get back to what I would hope was good. And with Sean, I started to progress some good results. I think the best I got in National Cross was about 11th or 12th. But the next day after that, it really flared up badly. That was in Perth, I think, 2005, or even 6 might have been. And then from that point, I was based with going in for surgery on my Achilles. So at that point, I sort of had a chat to a mate of mine, a guy called Toby Medlin, who sort of was just a bit stressed about his running. And I, you know, naively sort of suggested, well, look, if you want some help, I'm happy to help you. I don't think I'm going to be doing much for 6 months, and I'd like to stay involved actively in the sport. And took on Toby. I think he was about a 404, 407 sort of 1500 runner at the time. And that night went home, wrote 3 months of training for him, and got out on the bike and did every step of the way with him on the bike because I couldn't run. Toby went on that year to win the state champs and run 3:54 and go on to race at nationals. We were pretty stoked with that. And I think from that point, at the end of that year, my girlfriend at the time, Kate, her coach, Roger Pedrick, was stepping away from coaching. So they sort of scouted a number of coaches in Adelaide, and then I sort of said, look, if you want some help, have a chat to your crew, and if you want me to coach, I'll take it on. And so that was me starting on with the group. And then probably about 4 to 5 weeks later, Jess came back from overseas, and that's when I met her for the first time. I'd never met her before that. She came back to Adelaide after just travelling with her boyfriend for the time, and sort of came back to a new coach, and that was me. And we started working together from that point, and I guess that's just the history of it and the story of it. So that's where we've gotten to today, and we're probably, that's about 9, almost 10 years, I think, of working together from that point.
Yeah, you strike me as a guy just from those conversations and stories that very much lives his life by, I'll have a crack at that. You know, the move to, you know, obviously not lighting the world on fire when you're running, but the move to Ballarat's a pretty serious move, and I think just probably your approach to getting into coaching, pretty serious as well, but you just kind of put your hand up and jump straight in.
Yeah, I think probably in my younger years, I definitely wasn't like that. And I was a pretty shy and timid sort of kid. And I think my effort to put my hand up and go over to the US was probably the start of throwing myself in the deep end and trying to make it work. And you know, I wasn't always positive over there, but the experience on a whole made me grow up a little bit. And I guess coming back to Adelaide, I ended up moving over to Ballarat. Funny enough, I won one of the South Australian Athletic League races, the Bay Sheffield Select Mile.
Yeah,
Handicap
race.
Handicap race. And I won $2,000. I thought, right, I've got enough money to move to Ballarat now. And anyone who's moved interstate or moved anywhere kind of recognises after you pay the bond of your rental or whatever have you, you really haven't got much money left over $2,000. So it was a pretty difficult first 6 months. But managed to find my feet and, probably still hadn't really matured enough by the time I left Ballarat with Rod and sort of came back to Adelaide. And I guess I've probably had a bit of a fire in my belly after seeing things in Ballarat and Melbourne and recognising, look, nothing over in those places was that much better than what we had in Adelaide. There's nothing magic in the water that makes them run better. And I just sort of thought, well, you know, I'll do what I can to try and help South Australian running. And certainly at the point where I started coaching more, that was really fuel to my motivation, was to improve South Australia's sort of running. I know in the past, in the 70s and 80s, they were relatively strong, and it's kind of, you know, I thought there was no reason why, it's a fantastic training environment, why we couldn't get back there. And I guess it's probably the one thing that I'm really proud to be associated with what Jess has achieved. It's kind of given people in Adelaide, again, that belief that you don't have to move interstate to be a good runner. Adelaide's actually a perfectly fine location to run. You might have to be prepared to step interstate and race from time to time, but we even sort of organise races now where that's not so much a case. So No, I'm really proud of what South Australia is doing in the running, and you know, we've got some good coaches, you know, beginning to show what they can do. And certainly, I think we've always had the talent in South Australia, and we're starting to work out what to do with it now. So that's been really positive. And
yeah, you mentioned it wasn't in the water and obviously not in facilities, but what was it like? Just the culture of Ballarat and Melbourne, or what really kind of, I guess, stuck out to you when you left? What were you taking home with you?
Not to downplay those locations. I think they've just always grown up with having people at that level around them, whereas South Australia, there was that big lull where we didn't have that. And so just being surrounded by people, I still remember going up as a junior to Falls Creek just to, and it wasn't so much training up there. What certainly wasn't the altitude effect after 10 days, but it's just seeing what guys like Steve Monachetti, Lee Troop would do in training, seeing how they approached it and taking that back with me, that made the difference. And likewise, it was seeing the approach of a coach like Rod Griffin, who I thought was an absolutely sensational coach and really knew how to tune in and get a lot out of me that, that made the difference. And I probably took more away from having Rod coach me, and I really enjoyed his coaching style than anything else. I don't think there's anything magical about any of those places. I think it's just that you've got people there who believe they can do it. And I think in Adelaide there was such a long time between that we probably lost that belief that had to happen out of Adelaide. And like I said earlier, we kind of felt like we had to move into state to progress. And when I did that and felt like that wasn't the answer, it was the training I did. It was my coach's approach that made me the runner I was. And, you know, I mean, I got down to sometimes I was relatively happy with it. I got down to a sub 350, 1500, and that was what I was most proud of under Rod's coaching. And I was pretty stoked with that. I guess in that point of my career, you know, that was a huge win for me. I didn't think I'd ever do that at that stage of my career. I was already mid-20s. You know, if you're not showing the sort of potential to do that by then, you likely may not have that. And you know, certainly a bit different over the endurance events, but not over the 1500 and those sort of areas. So, yeah, it gave me a lot of confidence to be able to do some of those things and bring some of those training styles home.
Yeah, and you were pretty handy over five. You raced Zatopek a couple of times too, didn't you? Like a mid-30 at Zatopek?
Just the once, yeah. So I had one go at Zatopek and literally, I remember we had Craig Mottram come to town and he did a run with me in Adelaide, and I was coaching at this stage. And I said, oh, really, one day I would have loved to have run Zatopek. Well, he goes, well, go for it. I said, okay. Yeah, okay, easy said than done, Craig. I don't even know how I'm going to get in the damn race. And he said, he actually said to me, you just go and train and I'll take care of it. And I don't know if Craig had a word to anyone about it, but I got into it and was probably in the best 10K shape of my life and probably was really looking at a sub 30 that night. And I just remember it pissing down with rain.
Yeah,
and
I was gave watching.
It and I was about 30 and a half. And I was pretty stoked with that. I didn't have much more that night. And again, the Achilles flared up at that point. The very next day I could barely walk, and that didn't change for many weeks after that. So I kind of knew that that was about the extent I was going to get to. I was always going to get to this major race, you know, put everything on the track, and then the Achilles would flare up. And at that point it was the opposite Achilles, what I had surgery on. And that was really challenging going through the surgery and the rehab. And I didn't know that I had the ability to go through that again, nor did I kind of want to. I mean, my Achilles had surgery, still wasn't perfect. And my thoughts at that point were turning to, okay, I want to be a father one day and run around with my kids, and running's just not worth it for me anymore. I don't want to risk being able to do that. And even now, like, I've got two kids, and I'm running around, and half the time I'm running around, you know, with an Achilles it's hurting, but just going, you know what, bugger it. This is what I want to be able to do. If it means I can't run with the crew tomorrow, if it means I can't do my long runs, if it means I don't get to run that marathon, this is more important to me these days. So, yeah, it really doesn't bother me so much anymore.
Yeah, great response. And do you think the coaching kind of replaced that elite, sub-elite kind of athlete that you were pursuing?
No, not at all. I probably thought that was a good replacement at the time.
Yeah.
But the more I've gotten into coaching, the greater recognition I have for the complete difference between coach and athlete. I really advocate for coaches being non-competitive. I have no interest in, you know, being a better coach than another coach. I have no interest in having the top squad. I have no interest in having more athletes on a team than anyone else. My only interest is in get the best out of my athletes. And I think by doing that, not being that emotional sort of character within it, I'm probably putting myself in a position to make better decisions with those athletes. If I was trying to beat other people like I used to do as an athlete, I wanted to beat so-and-so and the rest of it, I'd probably make decisions with that in mind more so than what the best thing is for the athlete. And I don't want to be tempted by that. So, yeah, I never buy into any of that. And my only interest with the coaching is to get them better. And if they get to experience the level of competition that they're after, then you know, I'm stoked.
And was it like that from day one in your coaching career, or did it take a bit of progression to get to that view? Because that's important, like leaving your ego at the door a bit and, getting to that stage is, it's a great response, but was that obviously a bit of progression to get there?
Yeah, no, it was definitely a level of coach maturity that sort of took that. And I sort of reflected on that a little bit lately with a few things and recognised what I used to be like as a coach compared to where I'm at now. I might have said that I wasn't sort of competing with other coaches, but I think when you first start out, you do have a little bit of insecurity about what you're doing and you kind of want to prove yourself. And I guess, you know, the one thing we've got to recognise with coaching is we kind of trying to sell a version of faith to our athletes, that they have faith in what we can do with them and that we do know what we're doing. And I think in those early stages, you're trying to prove that to yourself and the other people around you. And that's kind of what draws athletes to you, getting those results. So I think you do essentially have that when you start off coaching, but it's something that as you mature, you start to realize it gets more in the way than it assists you. And you start to see things from a different perspective. At the same time, I do enjoy my athletes having good results. I'm not a priest. I don't believe that I should not be allowed to enjoy that. But I don't enjoy it for the reason of, we kicked ass today. It's more a case of, if they finish the race, they achieve what they want, and they're happy with what they achieved, and they're happy with what they asked me to do and what I was accountable to as a coach. And they feel that I facilitated that role well, then I'm happy. So that's the most important thing.
Do you find that sometimes difficult looking at other coaches, and especially in this day and age where, Instagram is kind of everyone's highlight reel and Facebook posts, and, you're trying to run a business as a coach as well, to not pump up your own athletes' tires when they perform well?
I guess the way I see their result is that I'm not actually involved in their result. So I've had this conversation with Richard Huggins, who's always been a good mentor of mine, and I said to Richard, like, I almost feel a little bit uncomfortable when say someone like Jess runs a good result and people say, oh, congratulations on Jess's result, and I find that a little bit uncomfortable because I didn't start, I didn't finish. I actually, from the time they start and finish, that's all them. I'm only involved in their preparation. So, if someone turned around and said, oh, look, you did a good job of preparing them, well done, then I'll sort of appreciate that a little bit more. But ultimately still, I'm just a guide. If the athlete chooses not to follow what I suggest, well, that's their choice. I can't make them do anything. So, I guess it is up to them. I've probably been in a position where I've given some of my best coaching efforts to athletes and the results still haven't come. And I've sort of recognised that some of the areas that they are failing to address and they're failing to be accountable as an athlete are in their control and not mine. All I can be is accountable to all the areas that I've said I will be. That's what I go from. So if I've ticked all those boxes, then I'm, that's what I'm responsible for. But certainly when they get on that start line, my role was just to prepare them to get there. And what they do from the start to the finish line, they own themselves.
Yeah, do you feel a bit powerless at times as well? Like I can imagine, Jess at a Con Games or an Olympics or something like that having such an input in the lead into it, as you kind of said, with all the training programs. But then once that gun goes, there's absolutely nothing you can do to help her implement her race.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Do your head in, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it does get a bit nerve-wracking, I'll admit to that. I guess someone like Jess is a bit of a different case. Yeah. I'm very confident in her to deliver, what we know she's capable of. I kind of reference Jess in the category of if I get her close to the shape she needs to be in, she'll take it to the next level. And that's what makes her such a damn good competitor, and why she's so consistent over the marathon. She thrives when she gets in those competitive situations. But yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, you are powerless, and I think sometimes you see the coaches screaming their lungs out, giving instructions and advice during the course of the race, and you know, 9 times out of 10, the athletes will say to you afterwards, when you say, oh, did you hear me say this? They'll say, no, I didn't even hear you. You know, they're so focused in the zone of what they're supposed to be doing. And you know, I like that they're like that. I like that they're prepared. I mean, the conversations that we have prepare them to be able to make those decisions, to be able to have that focus. That's the job's done there. They get on there and they need to be prepared. So I'm proud of them when they manage those situations, because honestly, that probably shows more respect to the level of coaching and interaction we have as coach and athlete than me telling him, oh, kick now or do this or do that. I mean, you know, like they have to be independent at that point. If they're not, then you kind of fail them as a coach to prepare them effectively enough. And, you know, I had this, it was a bit of a challenge, with Madeline. You know, I think she was kind of looking for almost a more definitive kind of approach and race plan to some races, but I kind of feel that you don't have that control over what others can do and what scenarios might play out during the race. And my best approach is, well, let's talk about the scenarios that may happen and how you might respond. And I'm more often than not would like to hear how they will respond. And then if I want to address that, if they think they could approach it in a different manner, then I'll say, well, have you thought about maybe doing this? Or the strength of that athlete may mean that you could handle it in this way. So, and I guess my viewpoint on that is sometimes you only get a split second to make a decision during the race. And at least I guess if we've almost visualized it, almost played it out in a scenario that we've discussed, that decision's going to be made a bit quicker and the influence of that move is going to be less. So, and likewise, I guess in London, World Champs for Jess, I mean, one of the major things we said to her was, you know, in our discussion, this was much earlier than we'd ever have our race discussions, was in St. Moritz. She said, oh, look, I'd kind of like to hear how you think I can race this. And we sat down in the coffee shop before we even left St. Moritz. It would have been a week out from the race. And I sat down and she goes, well, how do you think I can handle this? And I said, well, how would you like to race? And she goes, well, I'm feeling pretty good about what we're doing. And I said, well, I think this is the kind of race where you can take a risk and go with the leaders. And she says, good, because that's what I was hoping to do as well. So, I mean, sometimes when you understand each other as well as probably Jess and I do now, you kind of fall into that discussion is quite mutual because you kind of know where the athlete's at. And often I think that we're at this point where she's almost looking for a bit of reinforcement from me, not a definitive direction and decision on how she should run it. But she obviously gets confidence from hearing that I agree that that's a good approach. So, yeah, she likes to put me in the position to say it first, but, you know, I think I've got a pretty good understanding of her now that we can work those things pretty well.
I think one, I spoke to Jess after Melbourne half the other week, and she was telling me how she wasn't looking at her watch splits, just kind of going with the pace, and you kind of spoke then about a marathon plan, going with the leaders, and I think it's very kind of good to hear guys at your level talking about listening to the body and going with the pace and having a race and not getting caught up too much with splits and watches and what it's going to look like on Strava afterwards and things like that. So do you want to maybe just go on, like, is that something common with your athletes or something you believe in, a bit of a philosophy?
Oh, look, I think most trained athletes should have a fairly good understanding of their body, you know, especially at that level. I mean, you do enough training, and I certainly reference, I don't reference VO2 max or, you know, I do reference threshold a little bit because it's a little bit specific opposed to, you know, certain paces, but more often than not, I'll sort of reference most of their training to their race pace intensity. And often what used to occur is people would sort of line up and say, okay, so my 5K pace is this, so I need to run this 400 split in this. And I'd constantly be coming back to saying, okay, with the level of fatigue you've brought into this session, with the conditions that you've got today, with the fact you're running in racing flats and not spikes and you're running in a dirt path, take all of that into consideration. When you run your PB, you're generally freshened up, you're in spikes, you're more than likely in an optimal position to run a fast time. You can't expect those times in training. So So yeah, I do like them to tune into what their body says. And you know, sometimes I come back and say, oh, I was a bit slower than I should have been. I said, well, did it feel like the intensity it should be? And they said, yeah. I said, well, you hit the mark. So, yeah. And with Jess, with regards to marathon pace, I've always sort of referenced things in a specific phase very much to marathon pace. And I'd probably say the one I was proudest of and I probably totally unexpected was what Kane Corns did in his marathon. From my point of view, I was very concerned that he was going to stuff up the first half. And we spoke at lengths about this, and I said, no, you just need to hit it evenly. And still, you know, even after the discussion, I thought it might not happen. And he just hit it so brilliantly. And I think that's, he's responsible for why he got that result the way he did. Because for a guy who was probably, you know, much of a novice runner to some of those things, he controlled it, better than I thought he would. So, you know, each of those guys sort of, you know, when they go into races like that, recognize that. But sometimes it's just a case of you've got to respond to your competition. You've got to recognize what you're after out of a race. I mean, if you're looking specifically at a time, then sometimes you need to give yourself a bit of feedback on the time, but it needs to be feedback, not a driver. I mean, if you look down at your watch and you're a bit slow, but you're giving it what you believe is the right amount of intensity, then maybe you've got to accept that that's what the pace needs to be right that day. So you can't just be reckless and just totally governed by what your pace is, and I don't honestly believe that Garmin's are accurate enough for you to be really consistent with that. So you know, we know that there's, you know, a percentage out, so why take it as gospel? And we know that certain conditions, running through buildings and all this sort of stuff, can make a difference. And in Berlin Marathon, I had an athlete there, Jules Bennett, and she said she really got lost in her Garmin through that period. And I just said straight away, don't ever rely on your Garmin for your accurate feedback. You can use it as a guide, but it's not accurate. She said running through the buildings, it really just was way out. And I said, that's why we don't follow it, because we just can't rely on it being accurate enough.
Yeah, or just run with a stopwatch screen on and use the K markers on course, which have been measured appropriately. Yeah,
hey, yeah, more often than not.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, you never know, do you? I want to get back to the decision to become a full-time coach and go away from school teaching. I'm a school teacher myself, and I think it's pretty brave. You would have been probably at the top of the pay chain, pretty good at teaching after being there for 8 or 9 years, so you would have known what you're doing, pretty comfortable position to be in. You know, good money, and then the decision to pursue coaching full time, which is quite a risk.
Yeah, I mean, look,
hopefully, coach of the year, you've gone to the Olympics as a coach. Yeah, you've got some good stuff left, you know.
Well, I mean, for me, I was working at St. Michael's College, which I have. I had permanence there, and I'm still actually employed by them. I'm on leave, so I'm not totally out of it. But yeah, look, I mean, I basically, you know, to give a bit of perspective to how it came about for me, last year I came back from the Olympics, and it was a pretty tough year. And I've said, you know, fairly openly to some people, you know, when they've asked me about it, I said, look, I basically went to Rio and came back, and I decided 3 weeks out from Rio that I'd come back and I wasn't going to coach anymore. I had enough. It was a fairly stressful year for me.
Can I just stop you there and ask why? Like, what was the – obviously, that's a pretty big call.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's hard. I mean, so it's hard to explain to people, because you kind of look at, you know, going to that level as a bit of a pinnacle. But, I mean, you don't get there easily, and there's many, many challenges along the way. And it took a big toll on me that year, and I had many sleepless nights, and I probably more than anything, I saw the way it was negatively impacting on my family. Like I said, I've got two kids, and at that stage, my wife was heavily pregnant when I went to Rio and prior to that. So, you know, it was quite a challenging year in many regards, and you know, without going into details on why, I had to sort of manage that, and I just sort of thought to myself, I don't want to constantly be feeling like I was that year, and I was on edge a lot. And you know, I think that's just the challenge of anyone who pushes himself to a level that's uncomfortable. And I guess that's where we succeed more often than not. But I was in that situation. I mean, you've got to remember, it was a new thing for me. I had this time two athletes, and it took a lot of energy when I had one athlete going to Olympics. So having two was another, you know, there's a lot of energy spent with that. And you know, let's be honest. I mean, the years weren't going, it wasn't going pretty for both Jess and Maddie. You know, Jess had a fractured foot, and And I will always take a level of responsibility when my athletes are injured. I felt times where I probably should have said more to prevent it. And then Madeline went over to Europe and wasn't having good races. And so it's not easy to sort of absorb that. You do develop a level of resilience by going through that, but it's not necessary that you rock up to those moments in your life with that level of resilience in you. So I battled through that, and I guess by the time you're getting to an Olympics, you're kind of fraying. So I had to try and pull myself together before I left. But it was challenging. And even to the point where our very last session with Jess before she went to Rio, she said, "Oh, look, I'm pretty sure my foot's fractured again." And I had to go, "Oh, geez, this is something we'd been building for." And I'd put a fairly significant emphasis in Jess's career on Rio, knowing that that was a good chance for that to be a real pinnacle of her running career. And I'd planned for that moment for probably 6 years. So to see that things were crumbling around us, you know, that's not an easy thing just to go, "Oh, it's all good." So, you know, that, it was challenging me to deal with that. And not to mention that Madeline also got diagnosed with a fracture in her foot just before we went into the holding camp. So there I was going to the holding camp with two athletes, both with fractures in their feet. So there we were. We had to really get creative, come up with some plans to get them to the day and be able to allow them to perform. And with Jess, you know, it's no easy feat to go and run a marathon on a foot that's already fractured. And she was fairly confident in that, and I'd back her judgment on that. She reads her body very well, and is a very smart individual when it comes to all of that, being a physio herself. And Madeline, you know, we knew it wasn't severe at that point, but any kind of bone stress is severe enough. So, and it's hard for me not to take that on my shoulders and go, "Well, geez, have we completely stuffed this up this time?" And so we got to Florida, and there I was. Oh, beauty, we had an older G and used that quite effectively and got the girls to those final stages so that they could run well enough to get on the start line. Now, Jess, I was blown away by her performance. Yeah.
2:31, yeah.
Yeah, and to do that off of what would be 60 to 70% of her training in the months leading into that was cross training, not running. And I think people have to get perspective on that. We had to basically say 12 weeks out, which would probably be the signal of that's getting close to our specific phase of training. We still can't really run much. And I just said to her, "Look, you have to start recognizing this cross training is your marathon preparation. This scenario is not going to allow you to do and measure everything the way you have in the past. We have to manage it in a different way." And then, like I said, Madeline wasn't getting the results. And even though it wasn't stressing me too much in the early stages, because I thought, well, I wasn't expecting her to run well in May. I expected her to run well in August. And she had gone pretty well domestically, but had a bit of a niggle late just before nationals, to the point where she almost didn't run nationals, and we wanted to give her a chance just to secure her position. So she ran the steeple there and got that ticked off. But then we went into Florida and, yeah, had to sort of manage some things. Her confidence was a bit low after having a DNF at the London Diamond League. So basically we recognised she needed some confidence. She got a lot of confidence from her sessions. She needed to be able to give those a real good effort. Oh, she wasn't going to rock up in Rio with a great frame of mind. But at the same time, we had to recognise she was down for a steeple in the 5K, not just to get through the heat of a steeple, and we needed to manage his foot well enough so that she could get through heat and final of the steeple and preferably heat and final of the 5K as well. And knowing that the recovery time between the final of the steeple and the heat of the 5K was less than 24 hours. So we really couldn't be going in there with this, you know, really tender foot that she couldn't back up on. And running a steeple on a foot that's got a bit of stress to it is probably not the greatest idea. Wouldn't be on the top of the list. So we had to manage all of that. And look, you know, ultimately it was Rio Olympics was a fantastic experience. I think, you know, people would know that I no longer work with Madeline as a coach. And I think by the time I left Rio, I knew that we weren't going to continue on as coach and athlete. There were a few areas that we needed to address. And we when we sat down and discussed it, we recognized it wasn't going to work. So we decided to part ways and move on at that point. So that was a bit of a you know, hard thing to accept initially, but I sensed it and I knew it at the time when we left. But certainly through Rio, everything was just unreal. And Jess had a great result, and Madeline was just phenomenal, seventh in the steeple, and then to back up and run the heat and then the final of the 5K and come 10th there. I mean, it was really best case scenario, better than what I could have expected when I was flying off to Florida for the holding camp. So I was really proud of that. But still, I mean, it was still kind of lingering. It was almost like a hangover from the Olympics. And that's no shock. I mean, most coaches, even athletes, would go through that. I think we'd probably underplay the level of stress and almost that post-event depression that you get post-event. And I came home with a bit of that, and it was lingering. But it was really just seeing the athletes that I had at home and seeing these guys who weren't lining up for the Olympics but were throwing everything at it, and you can't help but be motivated and inspired by that, and seeing that just goes, that's why I love doing this. So I got through that point, and within that phase I'd said to my boss, because he knew I was really looking for something within athletics to take me out of teaching, and you know, every year for 4 years I was taking 3 or 4 weeks out of term three to go overseas to be a part of an Australian team. And I think I'd probably outworn that with the school, and going and asking for leave during school term had probably run out. And we recognised that too. And I said to him, look, don't worry, I'm not going to be looking for anything in athletics. I don't think that it exists. And so it's unlikely. And so he was sort of going, no worries, got Adam locked in. He'll be back here. We don't have to worry about that. You know, back in full focus.
Principal's worst nightmare, this stuff.
Yeah, well, in all fairness, you know, they employ me to do a job and they want my concentration 100% there. And I think he realised for much of that that I wasn't there, that my aim was to be out there as a coach. And so even as an employer, he was very good with me to support me, to allow me to do those things. And you know, I tried to give back what I could, but it probably doesn't add up to what I took as an employee. So, you know, coming into the start of this year, I had the opportunity and was asked if I'd be interested in working with Jared Talent, which I was, you know, really surprised that I was asked this question, and ultimately never coached a race walker, so it was pretty daunting. Yes. But
another step outside the comfort zone.
Yeah, but I was still excited. I mean, I, to be honest, I was damn honoured that I was even considered. So I said, well, sure. But the question was that my time availability needed to be more than what I currently had. And at that point, I was only working 0.8 as a teacher, so 4 days a week, and one day as a coaching coordinator at Athletic South Australia. And so I had a bit of flexibility when I did Athletic South Australia. As long as I got what I needed done, I could sort of be a little bit more flexible with what I did on that Friday. And so I said, yeah, I've got that available, but it was going to require a bit more than that. And race walkers, I mean, I think we need to appreciate their training, what they put them through, is just as hard as any marathoner, even sometimes more time consuming and taxing. But you know, there's not a lot of walkers for Jared to go out and walk with. So, so the need for a coach there to be there and be there on the bike riding with him and helping him out through some of his sessions was quite important. And so, so I had to make that decision, and we sort of worked out how I could financially afford to do this. And when I crossed the line of where I thought it was realistic, I took the leap. And I still do work as a teacher. I work at Westport Primary, where I teach PE 3 lessons a week and health the other 3 more lessons a week. So I have 2 afternoons there. And I'm really enjoying that too. So I'm not totally out of teaching, but I'm kind of working about 3 or 4 jobs at the moment to facilitate what I'm doing. So it's a bit of a juggling act, but enjoying it and enjoying the opportunity to be able to do a bit more with what I really want to do. So I guess, you know, financially it's a different situation, but at the same time, I don't think you can replace the enjoyment of doing something you're really passionate about, and that's the opportunity I've got here. And so I've decided to take it and roll with it, and my family supported me with it, and ultimately because of that and the flexibility of my days now, I get to spend a bit more time with my kids and attend some of the things that they do, you know, go and see my son do bounce, which is his kinder gym, and those sort of things, which I could never do when
important
I was
stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's even like, you know, you can go back to teaching and working full time as a teacher at a Catholic school or whatever it is, whereas this opportunity might not be there in 2 or 3 years' time, and you don't want to be that guy sitting in the pub in 20 years' time saying, what if?
I think I would have been rather frustrated if I didn't take this opportunity. And I think it would have only impacted on me being a teacher. I think I would have been that grumpy teacher that if I was still in the classroom in 10 years' time, I probably would have been one that wouldn't have offered too much to my students because I would have been too disgruntled to be there in the right mindset and all the rest of it. I think there's an importance there to the kids that, you know, that they don't need all your baggage. They don't need your moods. They need you to be there as their teacher and support them to learn. And I started to see some of that coming out in me because I wanted to be doing other things and I was very keen to move out, not because I disliked teaching, because I didn't want to become that teacher. So,
and yeah. And the passion obviously just got bigger and bigger for the running stuff. And when that passion goes up, I'm sure the passion to teach probably started dropping a bit because you probably can't sustain that high level of passion in two kind of jobs in a way.
Yeah, and the frustration too. I mean, you start to recognise that you can't do everything that that you want to do with your coaching. I mean, like just what I'm doing here, there's just no way I could have done this as a teacher. And I need to recognise how fortunate I am to be able to do this, be able to go on an international training camp prior to the World Champs. I was literally looking at the minimum amount of time I needed to be away in the past, whereas now I can sort of plan it out to be able to do what I wanted, what I need to do now. And it just wasn't even an option. It was like, okay, how little amount of time can I take off work? You know, so yeah.
Hey, how were you coping through all that kind of Olympic kind of ups and downs and roller coasters with the athlete? Like, did you have a sports cycle, someone you could talk to, or a good mentor? Or I think we focus so much on the athlete sometimes you forget about the coaches that are on the roller coaster with them.
Yeah, look, I mean, one of the things I really pride myself on is, you know, I committed to those two athletes to work with them. No matter what was going on and no matter how I felt, I needed to be consistent with them and I needed them to rely on that with me. They're going through incredible amounts of stress. And like I said, it certainly wasn't going to plan for either of the girls. And so, you know, it's certainly understandable when there was some frustrations and all the rest of it. I mean, ultimately, I think I couldn't expect everyone to be, you know, rosy with everything. I mean, ultimately, I'm responsible for their daily training environment, and if things aren't going well, I've got to take responsibility for that. I do and have for many years continued to work with a sports psych, and that's been, I think, a really important part of me as a coach. I think people fail to recognise coaches need to perform as well. They need to perform their role. They need to be bang on with what they're doing. I mean, we can't just have these expectations of the athletes to give their best. We need to make sure we're doing everything we can to be our best. And that comes down to trying to manage your emotions and how you feel and your stresses so that when the athlete communicates with you, you know, hopefully they don't pick up on that their stress. And hopefully, I mean, inevitably they will. I mean, they get to know you pretty well. And I kind of wear my heart on my sleeve a little bit, but inevitably you've got to take responsibility for how you do that. And I don't know. I mean, it's up to the girls if they felt I did that very well. I think if anything, it was probably my athletes back here in Adelaide who probably missed out on a bit of my coaching during that period because I was under. I was putting myself under so much pressure to try and find a way to make this all work for the girls, and ultimately, you know, we walked away from it very proud and happy with it. But I mean, like I said, every coach will respond to that in different ways, and I know what I'm like, and I know I have to take care of certain matters within me to make sure that I work well.
Yeah, and what kind of strategies were you putting in place to deal with that pressure? Because, you know, from the outside of looking into the Olympics, it's a pretty high pressure situation, and it probably mean more like the routines with bag checks and getting from one location to the other and all that kind of technical stuff, and then you've still got to perform on the biggest stage and you're the guy who's meant to be the level-headed one and not letting the pressure get to the athletes. So talk us through that a bit.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's different. I certainly didn't handle it very well in London compared to what I did in Rio. Different situations, though. I mean, personal coach in London meant that my access was very limited, and I let that get to me. And again, that's a lack of maturity as a coach. But I didn't know any different, so I guess I had my expectations weren't realistic. When I got to Rio, it was different. I was there not only to support my athletes, but to work with a number of athletes I was team coach for, and that meant working with them, working with their coaches. And I think just I didn't manage my fatigue well enough in Rio, so if I'm critical of myself, that was it. I think I've become quite relaxed in that environment now, not complacent, but relaxed to the point where being in that scenario doesn't doesn't stress me greatly. I do acknowledge and recognize that things aren't going to be easy. And I think if you do that, you sort of have a better resilience to when things are tough. I don't know. I mean, like, I think you just sort of have coping mechanisms, and that be talking to people who you know will be there as just someone to listen to you. It might be getting out and having a daily run so that you can function better because you just relieve a bit of stress. I mean, I overdid it in Rio. I mean, I was having, you know, probably 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night for the early days in competition, because we had athletes competing in the morning session and the evening session, and then you're coming home and you're preparing. And as a team coach, I was trying to provide personal coaches with statistics on the athletes who their athletes were running against. So, you know, I was doing a lot of research at night. Sometimes I wouldn't be getting to bed till 1 o'clock because I was slaving over trying to provide statistics to personal coaches so that they could work best with their athletes. Like I said, overdid it a bit. I can see that now, but just you're just trying to do the best you can. But ultimately, you know, I got sick in Rio because I overdid it, and that's my fault. I should have managed that better. So, yeah.
The classroom is probably a good place to deal with pressure and stuff as well. You would have moved some of your skills from the classroom into that coaching life.
Yeah, look, I mean, I found teaching quite interesting. I didn't really find it that challenging a job, and that might be different to other teachers, but I think might have been I've just been exposed to higher, more stressful situations that are probably at sometimes less rewarding. I mean, in the classroom you get paid really well, as we've mentioned. I never had any problems with that. I think the conditions of teaching are great. The work, I really enjoyed it. I didn't find it overly taxing, but the as a coach, you're pushing yourself outside your comfort zone often. And you have to certainly when you're working with athletes that I've been fortunate enough to work with. And I kind of worked into the teaching and the teachers are stressing about reports and, you know, this going on, that going on. And I'm going, yeah, it's no big deal, because at the same time I was dealing with probably another classroom worth of people, and that being my athletes. I had 30 athletes and, you know, issues going on out there, and I'd be spending my lunch and recess writing training programs rather than socializing in the staff room and getting numerous other things done within my day. So the teaching load never seemed to be too ridiculous for me. I kind of was relieved when that's all I had to do.
Yeah, that perspective's good. You're trying to prepare people to race Kenyans, not getting worried about all the small stuff that school teaching throws at you.
Yeah, sure.
Let's get on to the coaching, because obviously having your expertise and your time, I've got a million kind of nuts and bolt questions about coaching. And do you know Julian Spence? He sent me through a few questions as well. So a few of these have come from Julian down in Ballarat. So,
Julian and I, our relationship's probably to the point of we went on a buck show together, and that's the most we've spoken. A good mate of ours. And we got really talking a lot about running and those sorts of things. So, you know, go for it. I'm interested to hear what questions he's got as well.
Yeah, well, the first one, we discussed this on a podcast, the one we did leading up to Berlin all the time, was kind of thoughts on the traditional Australian marathon kind of training. So the Deeks, quarters, the monofartlek, the kind of shorter, sharper stuff to prepare for the marathon.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think... There's a lot of discussion about marathon training at the moment, especially in Australia. I think there's a lot of changes happening. I think we can't fail to recognise how well that approach worked. I mean, what Mona did offer that training was phenomenal, and we're not actually having athletes go to that level at the moment. So I very much asked the question of why we're trying to change it too much, because that was obviously a very, very good model. And I speak with Sean Crichton about this, you know, the typical training week of Sunday long run, Monday sort of got, you know, two runs of moderate sort of volume, then Tuesday session with a morning run, Wednesday, you know, second long run of the week, Thursday similar to Tuesday, Friday's your easy day, Saturday, you know, session and second run. And I said to Sean, I feel that nearly everyone in Australia follows a very similar model. And he said, well, that's because it's a good model. And I said, no, I think you're right. And I think if you look at load management principles, it really suits it very well. And it actually gets the most out of people. I said, Sean has I don't know that anyone's tried to significantly change that or evolve that over the last 20, 30 years. And I said, I kind of see the responsibility of this next generation of coaches to recognize that model and see where we can make enhancements. And I've looked at this a lot, and I was fortunate enough to have Lopez Lamong, based in Adelaide, at periods over the last couple of years because his wife was working out of Adelaide. She had a 2-year contract there, so we got to know, he and his wife quite well. And so I really delved in a lot of questions about what Jerry Schumacher does with the Bowman Track Club. And they work on a different cycle, a 10-day cycle, and that's quite foreign to us here in Australia. And looked at it, tried to implement it on many occasions, tried to see how we could coordinate things differently. But I mean, it basically comes down to, I think in Australia we've got a working class sort of group of athletes. There are not that many athletes that are full time athletes. So changing your training days, removing yourself from your group, not having a structured routine on a weekly basis that you can work within your uni, your schooling, your full-time job, which is more often the case than not, you kind of need that routine. So we always end up going back to this, I guess, this, you know, model of a 7-day cycle. And I keep saying to people, I probably work more on a 14-day cycle because I don't think we can get all the attributes we want in that 7 days. But I don't remove myself too much from I guess that model that Pat Clohessy sort of originated and Chris Wardlaw sort of made quite popular through his coaching as well and the athlete he coached. I don't think we should remove ourselves too much from that because it worked very well. I certainly would suggest I wouldn't say that the training that I give my athletes for the marathon is exactly the same. But I think sometimes I sort of witness too much of a polar opposites of, you know, significantly long tempos and you know, huge volume of sessions. And the one thing I do see a lot of people doing when they step up to the marathon is thinking, okay, we've got to start, if we're training for a marathon, we've actually got to start doing these massive sessions. And from my point of view, when we started training Jess for a marathon, her very first marathon, the volume of her sessions actually went down as the volume went up, because you can't just go, okay, volume up, session volume up. You've got to sort of think about that and go, okay, we need to balance this out. It was only when she started getting comfortable with the mileage that the volume of her training sessions, you know, repetition sessions and the likes went up. So, you know, I think it's something to be considered there. And now we've got a fairly good balance. I mean, we still do have quarters in our training programs. We still do have monofartlek. I had a joke of a monofartlek, well, not a monofartlek, but a fartlek session that I kind of have involved in my group called the Diddy K fartlek. And Diddy K comes out of my last name, Diddick, where my students in year 7 were writing raps for poetry. And they said, can we put you in our rap, Mr. Diddick? And I said, only if you use my rapper name. And they said, what's that? And I said, Diddy K. So jokingly, I wrote a fartlek session and named it Diddy K fartlek. And our group now does that, you know, fairly regularly. So,
And is it pretty similar to Mono? Do you mind sharing it for the listeners?
No, I don't mind sharing it. It's basically, it still works on, you know, it's not that different to a monofartlek. I'll be completely honest with you, which is why I've never really, you know,
just a different name.
Made it that popular. I mean, it's 3 minutes, then it's, then 2 by 2 minutes, and then 4 by 1 minutes. And you run, you float the recovery of what you're about to run. So after the 3 minutes, you float to 2 minutes. And after the second 2 minutes, you float to 1 minute. So they're the challenging aspects of it. And the only reason that came down is one is to try and build it into 20 minutes. But at the same time, I just felt that a 3-minute recovery after 3 minutes was too much. So I sort of cut that down and played around with it. And that's what came up. So, you know, a bit of mathematics and a bit of, you know, recognition of the recovery time. And we created that. So, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess the next kind of question leading on with that stuff is, how do you not get caught up with the excess information that's now available online and podcasts from different running coaches all over Australia and the world, to just stick to your guns and have confidence in what you're doing is working?
Yeah, to be completely honest with you, yours is probably one of the only podcasts I listen to, and it's because I enjoy hearing from the athletes that I know, and I like hearing their perspective on things and all the rest of it. But I don't really fall into the category too much. I mean, Steve Magnus, a podcast that I would listen to regularly in the early days, but after meeting Steve, I now have him as a phone conversation, so I'm really lucky like that. So if I've ever got a question about things, I'm more likely to give him a call and have a chat about it. And we get on quite well with regards to coaching, and we've actually just started something 2 weeks ago called Coaching with Craft, where it's a YouTube episode, one each week, where there's four coaches: myself, Steve Magnus, Danny Mackey, who's from Brooks Beast Track Club, and a guy called called John, who basically we just get a coaching question and throw it out there to all four of us. We all send in a video to Steve, and he puts it together and puts it on YouTube, and we sort of just have a bit of fun with answering those questions. And it's really open to any coaches to throw questions to us that we can then answer, and we'll just make that the theme of our week. So, you know, we have just sort of our role is to answer the question in 1 to 4 minutes to put towards the video, and we all add our own little different spin on it.
Well, that goes back to that sharing, kind of making each other better and not getting in a competitive kind of relationship with other coaches, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure. And look, Steve's a great mind to work with, and you know, I don't think I know all there is to know about coaching. I don't think I'll ever get to that. But there's certainly areas like the sciences which I do my best to understand, and I've probably got enough knowledge to keep up with the conversation. But you know, having access to a guy like Steve, Philo Saunders as well, is an amazing resource.
Yeah.
I've got, and even Eileen Robertson at SASE, and Ned Brothy Williams. I've just got these great people around that. You know, should I want something of a more sciencey sort of nature to explain a few things, I've got great minds to sort of tap into, and that's been very fortunate for me to have that. But I'm not your guru science sort of person. I'm the guy that failed science in school and sort of worked pretty hard to try and get on top of it, and now I really enjoy learning about it. But I'm never going to be at the level of an exercise physiologist, and I don't think I need to be a coach. I think they're separate things. You know, being able to understand and take advice and guidance from people in the science sort of realm, and then be able to apply and use it is another thing, and I think that's what coaches are responsible for.
Yeah, you haven't been on Let's Run forums today. Renata Canova's been on there dishing out some massive comments about marathon training sessions.
Yeah, look, I've read stuff in the past, and I think it all needs to be realistic. For some of the athletes that Renata Canova coaches, I mean, you know, it all comes down to a level of what each athlete can handle. I mean, I know that even the training I gave Madeline, you know, leading into the Olympics, she probably would have had the lowest volume training out of anyone that she got on the start line next to. But that's what her body could handle at the time. And I'm excited to see what she does over the coming years as she develops as a runner. But you know, we had less than 3 years from when she said she wanted to get back in athletics to get to the Olympics. So all of that stuff's irrelevant to me. I don't really have as much of an interest in what everyone else is doing rather than what the progressions are that are important to the athlete I coach. So people say, you know, do I keep all my training programs private? And I don't. If anyone wants to sit down and go through them, I'll open up all my books. I'll send you all the Excel spreadsheets of all the training programs. But what's important about it is delivering it with context. Strava, I'm actually one of those coaches that's against Strava, and I really, you know, not that Kane Corns knows that too much at the moment, as you guys would be following him, but
I want to get to that because he's smashing some stuff on Strava way too close to his marathon.
Yeah, we'll have a chat about that. But, basically, you know, I just think it's irresponsible for people to go and look at things like that and be influenced by it. I mean, it gives you good ideas, gives you some food for thought, but ultimately, everything you do has to be in relation to what your attributes are and what you need. I mean, you can approach a marathon in so many different ways, but you know what I do with Jess is specific to what's right for her. So as we build up her training, it's what could she do yesterday, and what do we need to get her to in 6 months' time? All right, let's look at the progressions we need to do to get from here to there. It's irrelevant what other people do, and the amount of speed work we do as opposed to tempo work. I mean, again, it comes down to what are the attributes that we're going for. I mean, for Jess leading into this year, it was about teaching her body how to run a fast marathon. So we took a very different approach to the marathons this year, and we'll take a rather different approach with appropriateness for what we want Com Games to be for her next year and what attributes we feel she needs to be successful. So each marathon is not just a mirror image of the last preparation. It's very different to that. And each athlete that I coach towards it will have a very different approach. There'll definitely be similarities. And even with some athletes, if they're training for similar events, have similar attributes, they'll have what looks almost like a carbon copy, but there'll be subtle changes in each of their programs that are specific to that individual. So they get their own personalized program with that in mind. So, yeah, what Kane did is very different to what Jess has done.
Yeah, and with those elite guys, though, do you have like a staple, like key marathon workout, you know, 4 or 5 weeks or 3 weeks out or whenever that generally everyone does, and it gives you a really good indication of what kind of shape they're in?
Yeah, generally. I mean, and it's one that Jack Colreevy shared.
Yeah, the 15K one, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's basically designed to be 3x5K. And this I think people need to recognize, is not something we're looking for a massive physiological advantage on or benefit from. We're basically – and look, no doubt you'll get something from it. I mean, any time you run, you're getting a benefit from it. But ultimately for us, it's about checking in as to what we think the marathon pace will be and what's realistic. So when we do the 3x5K, it's set up to be the middle 5K of that segment is supposed to be done at what we believe from the training done will be the marathon target pace. The first 5K will be 5 seconds per kilometre slower, and the third one will be 5 seconds per kilometre faster. Now, the idea of that is to strap on the heart rate monitor. That's crucial in this point. Doing that without the heart rate monitor is pointless. Because what we're looking for is at what pace actually really stresses them. So let's say Jack, when he was doing his 3x5K, was looking good and fairly steady and comfortable through the first 5K. The second 5K, it really spiked. Then we go, okay, maybe we're over, we're biting off more than we can chew. Maybe that pace isn't right for you. Or it might be the opposite. Maybe we don't see too much of a significant rise in heart rate, and then we go into the third 5K, and again, we don't see a real significant rate of heart rate. Well, okay, now we've just recognized that potentially the pace range can be faster than what we initially thought. So generally, I don't like to say, okay, you're hitting 330s. It'll be, okay, your range is between 325 and 330, or 330 and 335, and through doing that session, we get a pretty good understanding of that. We've done it a little bit differently for different circumstances. So for Jess, she's done it before all marathons except for her last one. And that was simply because she had a half marathon, probably in a similar time out to when we did that session. I'd just be putting it in there for the sake of it.
Yeah.
And I think we got enough feedback from the Gold Coast half marathon that we didn't need it. But that was the only marathon world champs that we didn't do the 3x5K. Jack Colreevy before Lake Biwa actually did something which reflected he was capable of far more than what we initially thought. Not that he'll say, because he doesn't like to make excuses or anything, but he didn't have the greatest day in Lake Biwa, and so we're still confident there's a much better run there, and he may not like me sharing that, but at the end of the day, you know, that's what this session gives you. And Kane, in actual fact, I had him do the session. He was in Melbourne for the AFL Grand Final and Trade Radio and all that sort of stuff for the AFL. So he was based in Melbourne. And so that's a pretty key session, and I was really keen to see it paced right. So Tim Crosby helped us out and jumped on the bike with him. And Kane's last 5K was actually much faster than we thought he could run. And so we were pretty confident in the pace. He hit it bang on. It gave us all the indications that he could run that pace. And I actually gave him a pace that would probably give him a range between 232 and 235. So we were pretty confident that he could run 235 at that point. And it just came down to him managing it on the day. And I guess one other way that Jess and I have done it certainly when she had her foot injuries, we had to be a little bit careful. So we actually cut it out a little bit, that she only ran a 5K in the middle one, but she ran like 3K on either side. And then leading into the London Marathon earlier this year, where she ran a PB, she did a straight 15K that day without any recovery. She did generally 3 minutes recovery in between. But she did a straight 15K, and that was simply because there wasn't much availability for a long sustained race effort. So we said, okay, let's focus on this, still picking it up every 5K, but it's going to be continuous. And when she came back with her heart rate being lower than it had been in the past and her pace ended up being faster, we knew that she was definitely in PB shape. We had no doubt about that. So it gave us good confidence. So I haven't yet had a situation where it's totally blown up. Jack, before World Champs, it had kind of blown out, but that was off of the back of a really large training week. So we're kind of recognising the fact that that fatigue would impact on some of those heart rates, and he got a bit frustrated he didn't get his pace right early. So, you know, a couple of things like that. You have to be realistic and look at all the variables, but ultimately it's a pretty good I think it's a pretty solid sort of recognition of what your pace might be.
Yeah, and then I guess you're looking at overall Ks and kind of hilly long runs and that kind of side of the training to prepare them for that kind of leg strength in the last kind of 5-7K? Like, because obviously that 15K, like, those boys be knocking that over pretty quick, like time on feet.
Yeah. I mean, that's all they do that day. They might do a second run. We don't add anything on outside of that. So it's just that 15K is all they do that day. But I guess I still go back to what the most important run of the week is for a marathon is that long run. And what we sort of suggested that we'd do with Jess in the early stages, because she really wasn't running much. In marathon context, she was maybe doing 140K at the most, training for 10Ks and half marathons. So when we decided to do a marathon, it wasn't like I was going to, you know, jack her up to 200K and all the rest of it. It's like, you know, okay, we might get to 155, 160. And so we thought, well, we've got to get creative with how we use these long runs. And so we started doing things like, okay, pick up last half an hour. And she would be very impressive with this. She'd get out to 2.5 hours, then she'd pick up over the last half an hour. And I still recall one day where she got down about 3:25 for the last part of that 2.5 hour run. And it was because she jumped in a race, so she got a little bit excited. But, you know, that to see that she could do that was rather impressive and sort of shows her strength. But, you know, you also got to look at the physiological benefits of doing that. You know, the glycogen depletion at that stage and stressing your body, I think, is a huge benefit. But I don't think it's the sort of thing you can do every week. So we phase it in at times, and we certainly don't do it every week leading into a into your taper. It probably is done a fortnightly at most.
Yeah, that makes sense. What about Julian? Had this one about the current state of the setup of Australian kind of elite distance groups. How they kind of a bit in Sydney, a bit with the Melbourne Track Club. You guys are over in Adelaide. How do you see that current situation?
I guess endurance running is quite interesting. I mean, you do get a group effect from getting people together, and I think that's invaluable. But I think it's also a very it's not an overly complex thing, distance running. So, like, I coach athletes, you know, all around the country, and if they're independent enough, that I don't see any issues with that. I think the strength in Australia will be if we continue to set up groups, in each sort of city. I mean, ultimately, like I said, there was this need for me to, or this feeling that I needed to go into state because it wasn't the strength to take me to the level I wanted to go to in Adelaide. I mean, I never got to the level I thought I wanted that I wanted to go to anyway, so it might have been rather irrelevant. But if we've actually got good coaching in each major city, and hopefully more than one, you know, really good coach with experience at a high performance level, then we've got a situation that when the talent comes through, there's someone to facilitate and nurture and foster that talent and get their potential out of them. So ultimately the aim, I think, for Australia needs to be to develop high performance level coaches in numerous areas. And the more of those coaches we have educated and prepared and experienced to do that, the better our country is going to be, because it'll mean that talent that maybe is not prepared to move in state or whatever is going to be looked after. Mm. And that's going to capture the potential of our country. I also think that, you know, that's something we do have to focus on, is trying to get more coaches experienced. And it's a worthwhile investment for Athletics Australia, whoever, is to continually train these coaches up, because ultimately they're going to give back for many generations of runners. And so it's important to build that effectively.
Yeah, it's spread them all around the country. Like, you look at every town in Australia, like Little Ats is booming, but there's just that massive drop-off, maybe because there's just not the senior coaches to take them on later on in life.
Yeah, and that being said, I mean, I think there's so many challenges to taking on, maybe more specifically endurance running we can talk about, but it's not an easy sport. I mean, it's obsessive and it's great, but it actually does affect a number of areas of your life, and it takes a lot of skill, and it's something I'm really impressed with the athletes that I coach, the way they do manage that, and that's something that's really important, because it'd be easy to go home and sit on the couch and eat Tim Tams. But if you sort of have that opportunity, if you develop that love for it and you have a passion for it, it can be it can be quite absorbing of your whole life. So you've got to be very careful to keep some perspective on all of it. And as Madeline used to always say, you know, I'm only training to run around in circles fast. It's not curing cancer or rocket science.
Yeah.
So let's keep a bit of perspective on it.
1 foot in front of the other as fast as you can.
Exactly.
Pretty much. Yeah. Hey, current state of female and male Australian distance, or I guess marathon runners, as the marathon coach at the last Olympics, it must kind of excite you, especially with the female marathoners at the moment. And the guys are, you know, Michael and Liam, 2:12, and Chris Hamer, 2:13, lead into the Comm Games.
Yeah, look, I think the women are doing a phenomenal job with their marathoning, and it's great to see. I mean, literally, it's going to take a 2:29 to get on the Commonwealth Games team for a female. I mean, irrespective of what the qualifying time is, that just shows the standard of Australian marathoning. And if you look at where they're positioning themselves in Australia's all-time lists, I mean, you just have to recognise that this is probably a real positive period for female marathoning. And you know, it does, you see one person break through, that gives belief for the next person to do it. And I think that's happened in Australia with female marathoning. And I think likewise, we have the potential for the same impact to happen with the males. Once we get someone under 2:10, there's going to be a whole lot of other people that are going to think, well, I can do that too. And they'll approach it with that belief that they can do it too.
To interrupt, Adam, but what have they got to do? Like, these guys, they're training hard, like I'm sure Michael Shelley and Liam Adams, and the talent's obviously there. So why haven't we seen that guy go under 2:10 for so long?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I think it'd be naive of me to try and answer the question because I don't know enough about what Michael does.
Yeah,
I don't know enough about what Liam does. I mean, I haven't looked at their program. I haven't discussed it with them. I respect that their coaches are doing a great job. So, you know, it'd be unfair for me to make that comment. I think we've got a whole lot of guys around that sort of 2:17, 2:18, which I hope to see go down to 2:14 and below. You know, I've seen the capabilities of, well, certainly Jack, who I coach. I'm really excited for what we can do with him in the future. And certainly, you know, I've witnessed what Josh Harris has done on numerous occasions in training and chatted a lot with him about his training and leading into certain marathons. So, you know, I have a lot of faith that he can really bring his time down as well. So, you know, that sub 2:10, well, I mean, it's there for them. I mean, I can certainly attest to the fact that Michael Shelley's turning over every stone to try and get himself there. I mean, that guy's been unbelievably consistent at that 2:11, and you know, you sort of feel for him. You know that he wants it, and I think he's got a great chance of doing that within his next marathon. I certainly think he's going to be rocking up on the Gold Coast with the capabilities of doing that to match anyone who's a sub 2:10 runner. So Liam Adams is quite capable of that too, and Chris Hamer, well, what a debut! It'll be exciting to see what he can go on with.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting, isn't it? And I guess for you being like in this position leading into the home Commonwealth Games, it must excite you in your role as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to sort of even see the impact it can have on a city. I went to Melbourne Commonwealth Games as a spectator and just saw the buzz around it. And I think Commonwealth Games is really special to Australians. To be able to have some of the athletes that I work with being able to run in a home Commonwealth Games, major championship, whatever it is, world champs, Olympics. I mean, it's all very special to be able to get out there and do it on your home turf. So I know it's something that excites them. I know it's something that people are putting a big emphasis on. But I think ultimately we have the opportunity to see some outstanding performance by Australian athletes. And typically, I think as we sort of hope that they've got every facility, leg up to do that. So, Athletics Australia is doing a great job, from what I can see, to support people to do it. And you know, the athletes and the coaches have to work really hard between now and then and get on the line and take care of it.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, this is a bit generic, and I'm not sure if you can. It's probably similar to that question, why those guys aren't breaking 2:10. But I was thinking of the listeners out there who are trying to break 3 hours and trying to break 4 hours, and I know you don't know their context and how much training they're actually doing a week, but one bit of advice as a pretty credentialed coach that you could give to those guys to get the best out of their running?
I guess probably similar to something I said earlier about, you know, going to the marathon and people expecting you have to do more of everything. I think I've seen, I coach with recreational runners. I have a business called Tempo Run Coach. And so I do work. I've got about, we've got about eight, I think, from that business, going over to, New York Marathon. And they range, from people who are, you know, trying to get in the low 3 hours to people trying to break 5 hours. So, so in context with that, and I get asked the same question by all of them, should my long run be longer? And I'll say similar to what I said earlier about the training for anyone is it should be in context of what you can progress towards and be healthy with. I mean, too many marathoners, even around that 3 hour level, that non-elite level, if you want to call it that, will basically, try and get out to running, you know, 40K or something like that close to the marathon. But you've got to think about the stress that puts on their bodies and the recovery. And I don't know that it's always the most conducive thing for them to improve. I think they've just got to take one step at a time. If they want to improve their time, maybe they've got to improve the way they bring some intensity into that long run rather than just go, I've got to try and hit 40K. It might be like with Kane, as I know he spoke to you about last week or the week before, it was not a case of going out to 2.5 hours like Jess does. It was about going to 2 hours because I couldn't settle him down to the point on his long runs that I could safely take him out to 2.5 hours. He'd basically be running a marathon with the pace he was doing it. Yeah. So I said, no, two hours is enough for you, buddy. Any further, you're going to dig yourself a hole. So you just got to take those progressions, what's right for you, not read a magazine article saying that you need to get this percentage of your marathon volume and all the rest of it. All of that's got to be irrespective. You just got to slowly progress things safely so that at least you get to the start line. And if you get there without a niggle, if you get there healthy, you've got a better chance of running the time you want.
And I guess that leads into common mistakes people make. Like, is it jogging too fast or trying to go too close to race distance, or just ones that have come across your desk in the past maybe 6 months that you see and you just start cringing and shaking your head?
Yeah, going too fast in long runs is generally the way, but also just progressing too fast, trying to do too much volume, too much intensity at the same time. So session volumes increasing too much, as I mentioned earlier as well. You know, just being realistic with what you can do. That's it. The biggest challenge I sort of face with recreational runners is more the case of how do they manage things when that niggle occurs? How do they recognize that, okay, I might need to back off for a couple of days? What does that look like? And ultimately, I don't think the athletes I work with in that realm really use me enough to sort of say, oh, this has been hurting a bit. What should I do? And more often than not, they're surprised at how little I give them in those coming days. But it's the same thing. Keep your body healthy, keep yourself uninjured, stay running more days than not, and you're going to get further. I mean, if you push yourself from something that might be 2 or 3 days off to a 3 week injury, it's a no brainer.
Mm. And post-marathon, Adam, I know there's a few of us boys with post-marathon depression at the moment on the way back from Berlin, and heaps of guys have just finished off at Melbourne. It's probably one thing that we don't focus on a lot. You always focus on building up to the race and your long runs and your nutrition, all those kind of things, but then the marathon finishes up and you're not really sure when to get back into things or how soon's too soon. But do you have a bit of a philosophy around that?
Yeah, my philosophy aligns a lot with what Chris Wardlaw spoke to me about when we first started in recovery, and I asked him that exact same question, and he said, Adam, that generally it's 1 day for every mile every you run mile, before yeah. you do anything with intensity. So, you know, it gives you about 26 days. So you're basically looking at about 3 weeks before you start doing anything in intensity. And then, so, you know, you can jog, but, you know, honestly, I like Michael Shelley's approach to it as he takes a pair of shoes whenever he goes to an international marathon, and it's a pair of shoes that as soon as he sort of finishes the marathon, he throws out. This is his training shoes, and doesn't buy a new pair of shoes until he feels ready and wants to get back into training. And I always like that because I think often people are thinking the physical but are failing to recognize the mental and emotional drain that preparing for such a big moment takes on you. And even last year with Jess after Rio, I said, you take as long as you want. If you want to not run until, you know, start of next year, go for it. You know, take whatever time you need. And when you feel ready to and motivated to get back into training, that's when we'll start training. So I think ultimately in those days after a marathon, you don't need to be going out running. You don't need to. And those who are trying to capitalize on the training gain that they made from doing the marathon is just silly. I mean, you know, marathons aren't the sort of things that need to be run every week. So let's just be smart about it. I mean, I think when you look on load principles, that's a fairly significant load. It's a long, it's a hard run. So respect the race, give yourself enough time to recover, and then build up when your body's ready. I mean, one of the articles I read once when Jess was first starting marathoning was the neurological sort of trauma that your body goes through. And again, that was even suggested that it was, you know, close to 3 weeks before you sort of get that proprioception fully returning. And I'd even say to Jess, she'd come up to me at times and, you know, this is not to make fun of Jess because ultimately it sort of just proves the point. She goes, I feel really springy today. And I say, do you? I said, it doesn't look like it at all. And you sort of see people that proprioception hasn't quite returned and they don't quite realize it because you're just not getting that feedback effectively. And that's just the trauma of a marathon. So you have to just respect that. You have to give yourself the time to recover from that and hopefully start setting yourself some ideas as to how you can do it better next time and then set your goal on what you're going to do next.
Yeah, so, no point rushing it back.
No, exactly.
One thing you've learned about yourself, mate, through all these experiences as coaching and Com Games at Glasgow and Rio and, kind of all the bird's nest over at the World Champs in Beijing, something you've learned about yourself through it all.
Yeah, I don't know. Something I've learned is I'm a lot calmer under pressure than I ever thought I was. Like I said, I grew up as a pretty nervous kid, so I never kind of thought I was that cool sort of character under pressure. I sort of went to London Olympics, and I know my heart was beating pretty hard before the race, and I thought, okay, I don't want Jess to think I'm nervous or anything, because I really was, and I was pretty excited on the day, but I didn't want her to think I was stressed, and she popped out from to warm up, and I sort of got about a road's width away from her. That was the closest I could get. And she looks at me straight as she comes out. She goes, geez, you look nervous. I go, oh, bugger, I'll stuff that one up. And I said, oh, I'm actually not. I'm pretty excited about today, you know. And I thought, oh, and then she ran off. And I thought, oh, geez, I hope that doesn't rub off that she's stressed because she sees me stressed. But from that point, I remember going to Rio and prior to Maddie running in the steeplechase final. And I knew she was a good chance to run top eight there. So I was very hopeful, I guess. And I remember just taking my heart rate when I was in the middle of the warm-up track as she was doing her final strides, and my heart rate was something like 54 or something like that.
Yeah,
I thought,
right.
Okay, I think I've taken on that. But like I said earlier, that comes with a bit of maturity, that comes with the opportunity to be experienced in that situation. You know, no doubt there'll be things that'll rattle me from time to time, but yeah, I don't know. It's something that comes over me in those experiences where I generally feel like I can cope with situations better than I would in any other day of my life. So, it's a bit weird. I don't know how to explain it, but that's probably
good characteristic to have, though, I reckon, in high pressure situations.
Yeah, I guess so.
Hey, mate, the final question I ask everyone who comes on the podcast is if they have a mantra or a life quote or a philosophy that they try to live by, hang above their bed, whatever it may be. Have you got anything?
One I've had for about 10 years, and it's a bit of a joke with some of my guys, but it's never trust a man with a ponytail.
man buns are back in.
Just don't see a point in them. That's just a bit of a joke, but that's rule number one. No, not really. I don't really have a mantra. I guess the closest thing I have to a coaching philosophy, and I had this discussion with some coaches the other day. Everyone's always pushing, you need to have a coaching philosophy. And I think that mine evolves as my experience evolves. But what always comes down to something that's sound within my approach as a coach is to promote a balanced approach to training. So that means in how you approach it, in perspective, in making sure that you're factoring in other aspects of your life and not just getting too obsessed and absorbed with your running. So if that means, your work you need to invest a bit of time in, or your family, that has to be catered for, because at the end of the day, if those areas of your life are going to crap, then that's probably going to stress you out and impact on your running anyway. So that's probably my... probably the thing that athletes that hopefully have sort of taken away from my approach is to have that balance. And probably as a coach, I recognize that as well. And sometimes I feel like I let athletes down by not getting out to a race or whatever have you. But I hate to say it, but my family is my number one, and I think my athletes need to recognise that. To me, it's worse if I let them down than my athletes. As much as I put a lot of pride in what I do as a coach, there's perspective there, and hopefully that perspective supports my approach to athletes, and they can learn from that to do the same.
Yeah, and if that keeps you healthy as a person and in a good mood, of course they'd want to be dealing with you in that mood rather than annoyed that you're not with your family.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there's a lot to that. I mean, I really value the relationship I have with my kids and my wife. And if that wasn't positive for me, I don't know how I'd operate effectively as a coach either.
Yeah, beautiful, mate. Hey, where can people find you online if they want to get in contact?
Yeah, so website that we've currently got rolling is temporuncoach.com. There's obviously I'm on Instagram and Facebook and the likes. Team Tempo is the competitive side of our business. We generally have a lot of updates and things on Facebook and the rest of it. And I've got some pretty clever guys in our group, Matt and Andy Axford, who make us look better than we are. But
they're good on Strava. On Instagram, those boys.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, they're good. And up to Falls Creek, you guys heading up there over Christmas and summer?
No, not heading to Falls Creek. I haven't for quite some time. And it's just about timing and affordability for athletes coming from Adelaide. I'm this year looking to have a training camp in Adelaide, based around Kuiper Forest, about 40 minutes out of Adelaide, just so that the athletes can have a bit of access to work. I mean, like I said earlier, Adelaide's a great training environment, but we recognise we have to get out and race a little bit. So if going to Falls Creek affected the athletes' finances that they didn't race, I don't really see a point in it. And with uni students and the likes, I think it's important just to keep all of that in perspective. And, yeah, that we'll set something up in Adelaide.
Back to that balance quote.
Correct, yeah.
Spot on, mate. Thanks again for your time. It's really it's been really good talking running and getting into the marathon stuff, and yeah, I really appreciate giving us the opportunity to talk to you, and I'm sure there'd be so many listeners that would get some pearls of wisdom out of that chat tonight.
Anytime, Brady.
No worries at all. Thanks, Adam.
Thanks.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.